you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And so for me coming home, this was the crisis. The gun violence was the crisis facing the city. And the city's fans give me every opportunity, you know, educationally, athletically, socially, culturally. So for me to come home and not try and really tackle this issue of violence and just give kids on the south and west sides of childhoods back, I couldn't have lived with myself.
Hi, everybody. I'm Fran Spielman. And with us today is former U.S. Education Secretary and Chicago Public Schools CEO before that, Arnie Duncan. Arnie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
I take it you're not playing a whole lot of basketball anymore, at least during the pandemic. You are a former professional basketball player in Australia, former captain of the Harvard basketball team. Are you still playing?
I'm not playing. I miss it. I'm running every morning. I hate running. I want to get a ball back in my hand. So hopefully one of these days I'll be able to get back in the gym.
You are now serving as managing partner of the Emerson Collective. That is the venture fund founded by the widow of billionaire Steve Jobs. You're also founder of Chicago CRED, Create Real Economic Destiny. Both really aim to do kind of the same thing, don't they, to create opportunity and hope for half of the young Black men who studies show are disconnected from work and school, right?
Yeah, and this work is really, really personal, Fran. I started to lose friends to gun violence when I was a teen here in Chicago. And when you're a young kid like that, I think it shapes you and frankly scars you in ways that are pretty difficult to talk about. And during my time in Chicago Public Schools, lots of things I'm proud of, lots of things I'd be happy to talk to you about all day long. But during my watch, on my time, 7.5 years leading the public schools, on average, we had a student killed every 2 weeks due to gun violence. It was just a devastating, devastating loss of life. And thank goodness, never in a school, but on the bus going home, walking to the corner store, you know, in a living room shot by an AK-47 from 100 yards away on a Wednesday morning, you know, on a school day. And I don't think I know we as adults, as leaders, fail to keep our kids safe. And to show how naive I am, when our family left to go to D.C. in 2009, I thought as a city we were at rock bottom. And unfortunately, in the 7 years we were gone, things got worse for a lot of reasons. And so for me coming home, this was the crisis. The gun violence was the crisis facing the city. And the city's fans give me every opportunity, you know, educationally, athletically, socially, culturally. So for me to come home and not try and really tackle this issue of violence and just give kids on the south and west sides of childhoods back, I couldn't have lived with myself.
So here it is surging yet again to levels that we have not seen in this city since 2016, maybe even will top that. Innocent young children, as young as 20 months old, getting caught in the crossfire every single weekend. It is absolutely heartbreaking. Chicago has become the killing field. What is going on and how do we stop it?
Well, we started this work with young men on the south and west sides in 2016. And in 2017, 2018, 2019, we saw double-digit reductions in both shootings and homicides every single year. And we have a long, long way to go. We try and do a number of things. We have amazing street outreach teams that work with guys. They bring them into our programming. We then do a number of things. We have a phenomenal clinical team that helps young men work through their trauma. We have an education team. We've had over 100 guys get high school diplomas. We have a set of guys starting college this fall, which is really exciting. We do jobs, work, hard and soft skills, and we have employers hiring to back in. So we, as a city, we're making some real progress. We work with amazing nonprofit partners across the city. We're seeing real progress, but this year, Fran, as you know, has been tough the entire year. This was pre-pandemic. January was a bad month. February was a bad month. March was a bad month. And it's continued. We've continued to struggle. The 20-month-old you talked about, Sincere Gaston, that was actually the son of one of the young men in our program, Thomas Gaston. And post George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis has been, without doubt, the hardest period of our work. And we've never lost. We have lost young men we work with. We have never lost a baby before. And just being present with a family through this has been one of the most challenging times of my life. I can't say it any differently than that. Dad was typical of many, is typical of many young men to work with, had a lot of challenges, but has really been working hard to get his life together. He's actually been doing a really good job with us. Having his son really helped to get him more on the straight and narrow. He's actually been an amazing father, and the part that's so heartbreaking is he brought his son to our program all the time. And, people saw him grow up, saw him, start to walk. And it's just seeing him in a casket a couple of days ago. Never seen a casket that small, Fran, and I hope I never see one again. For all the challenges of the city, and it's a really, really difficult time, I just want to, and we don't begin to have all the answers by any stretch, Fran, we're just a small part of the solution, but city, we're up 38% on violence year to date, but the community where we have worked the longest and we're the deepest out south, Rose and Pullman, that's actually down 38%. And the contrast between those two numbers is really, really interesting. And the 4th of July weekend, it was so tough across the city. We only saw one shooting in that community. And so it actually, in a really, really dark, difficult, challenging time, I'm actually hopeful. And I look at what our outreach team did that weekend. I was out, spent some time with them, and to see how hard they're working. We had teams out till 2 a.m. There are guys where we were worried about conflicts where we got them out of town and just let people cool off and get a little bit of a break. See, the police, we're a good partner, working in different communities. We have not just outreach workers, but we have other folks who work in what we call hot spots, specific areas that are known to have significant violence historically. And so just seeing that type of intensive strategic work, putting in place non-aggression agreements between groups that are in conflict, I actually think, Fran, that we know what can happen when you're willing to be that intentional and that strategic and that grounded in the reality of communities.
So what do you see happening? I mean, we're seeing similar spikes in other cities like New York and Atlanta, and even a little bit in LA. What is it that's going on post-pandemic and post-George Floyd? Is it the police laying back? What is going on that's causing this?
Yeah, it's so complex, as you know, and there's no one answer. And every city, has a different story. And I don't pretend to be an expert in any of this stuff, but I do think in many ways it's a perfect storm. People who have been, cooped up with COVID, now coming out of their homes. I do think, police are, not all police, but some police are more, stepping back a little bit more conservative. Tremendous anger and outrage coming out of George Floyd's a murder. But those are all, for me, short-term stuff. And at the end of the day, we have to build healthy communities. We can't police our way out of this. We can't arrest our way out of this. Unfortunately, every gun the police pick up, guns keep flooding our city. And I just keep saying we have to create hope and opportunity. We have to keep working with these young men. We have to help them heal from a lifetime of trauma. The police have a role to play, but in their thing, you know, if they solved more murders, that would be extraordinarily helpful. So much of this violence is driven by retaliation because there's no justice in traditional systems. So then you have street justice. But we have to be willing to work with these men. We have to be willing to build healthy communities that haven't existed, you know, forever. Since Martin Luther King came here in the 60s or before. So we have to deal with a crisis, but we have to plan for the long haul. And I don't think we've been intentional enough or strategic enough about doing that.
So explain for us, how does your organization work? What do you do? Is it just person by person? Tell us what you do for them.
It's what we do together. And I always say these are young men. These are not little kids. And we are co-creating with them. We are learning from them. We're walking with them, checking all the time what's working and what's not. So the initial contact of us is through street outreach teams. And these are guys who have tremendous credibility with the different groups, with the different cliques. And they're able to talk to young men and ask them to give us a chance. And, you know, these guys have been lied to so many times and have had so many things, you know, so many people, so many programs give up on them. They can be justifiably very, you know, cynical and skeptical. But once they come into us, we try and surround them with just a team of adults who are just totally focused on their long-term success. So we have amazing life coaches, many of whom have frankly served significant time in prison and have come out and dedicated their lives to giving back to the community, trying to right their wrongs. And we always say experience can be the best teacher, but it doesn't have to be your experience. It can be somebody else's experience. And you'll learn from them and do some things differently. So the life coaches are huge. As I said, we have an amazing clinical team. And our guys have generally, and every man's story is different. We actually work with some young women as well now. But many have dealt with trauma their entire lives. It's not like they had great lives and then at 16 or 17 something went wrong. They've dealt with trauma their entire, you know, from birth. And we have to help people heal. We say, you know, hurt people hurt people. And that healing, that journey's, you know, transformative, but can take some time. The education component is really important to see young men who, you know, never thought they would graduate from high school, some of whom actually left school before they even made it to high school, to see them getting those high school diplomas and seeing some now going to college has been extraordinary. And then I always say they're going to make money. They're going to pay rent. They're going to eat. They're going to take care of their kids. And they're going to do that in the legal economy or in the illegal economy. And that's up to us, man, as a city. And we work and help to get them, you know, ready for jobs. We have people working in healthcare and manufacturing and hospitality and culinary and construction. We have a couple guys working in law firms downtown, which is amazing. We have one guy working at Deloitte. And we just need employers to decide that they're going to be part of the solution. That if they're not willing to hire, if they lock people out of the economy, the legal economy, they force them to go back to the illegal economy. So this is multifaceted. There's no one simple answer. We're making mistakes every single day and learning hard lessons and trying to get better. But we as a city have to commit to solving this problem. And that's everyone. That's the faith-based community. That's nonprofits, social service agencies. But the business community has to step and play higher. And we have to rebuild these communities. You look at all these vacant lots in the neighborhoods where we work. What if we were building thousands of homes, south and west sides, and hiring young men from the community to work on those projects and, you know, literally helping to rebuild rather than tear down the neighborhoods? That's the kind of investment we need to make if we're serious about giving our children their childhoods back.
But this is such labor intensive work. So what's the capacity? How many people can you serve at one time?
This is all relationship based. I always say programs don't change lives, relationships do. And so we work with fantastic nonprofit partners, faith partners on the south and west sides. We're working collectively, probably with about 500 men now. We've slowed down the intake during the COVID time. Unfortunately, we need to sort of ramp that back up as we slowly try and open safely. But we're not, I don't know what the magic number of young men who need these kinds of opportunities. And I always say that I think we're giving, in most cases, a first chance, not a second chance. People often say, oh, it's great you're giving people a second chance. I often think that they've never had a real chance before. But it's not, no one really knows a hard number, but let's say it's 2,000 men or 3,000 men, whatever it may be. I don't think it's 10,000, Fran. And I think as a city, if we're not willing to make a commitment to giving everybody an opportunity to do something better with their lives, and this is not a get out of jail free card. If they do something, they should be held accountable. But we're not going to arrest our way out of this. We're not going to incarcerate our way out of this. The police, as we know, really struggle to solve crimes. And we have to give guys a reason to put down the guns, to have hope. And that's what this is all about.
So what is the population of young men that we need to reach to really reduce the violence?
Yeah, I think, my best guess, and it is just a guess, is, somewhere in that, 2,000 to 3,000 range. And we're trying to work really at that crisis point, those young men, 17 to 24, who are most at risk of shooting and being shot. Many of our men, unfortunately, have been shot. Many, unfortunately, have shot others. We've had a couple instances where guys in our program have literally shot at each other in the past, and we've seen them reconcile, and that's an extraordinary event to witness. But I just think as a city with all of our, corporate and philanthropic, resources, if we're unwilling to commit to helping a couple thousand men, have a chance at life, then shame on us. Then we're just not, we're talking about the problem. We're admiring the problem and not trying to solve it. And we all have a role to play here. Again, if employers aren't willing to hire, and our guys have, many have criminal backgrounds and some, violent backgrounds. But those are things they did when they were younger. And there are young men who I would, trust to take care of my kids. And it's just, if we judge everybody by the worst thing they did in their life, I'll speak for myself, I wouldn't have had the opportunities that I've had. And you can't just look at what people did, at their lowest moment. You got to look at how committed they are to transformation. And we see how hard these guys are working to be positive community leaders, to be the fathers for their children that they never had, to reduce the violence, to keep their communities safer, to see them putting in place peace treaties and non-aggression agreements with guys where there's been way too much bloodshed on both sides, to see them having the courage to do that. This is some of the most heartbreaking and toughest work I've ever done, Fran, but it's honestly easily the most inspiring and hopeful work that I've done. And these guys are leaders, and we just have to, again, walk with them, learn from them, and they will lead us. They're not a problem. They're the solution. They're going to lead us to a safer city if we walk with them.
In New York, the mayor's office to prevent gun violence has $38 million budget. The Los Angeles mayor's office of gang reduction and youth development has $36 million. In Chicago, a new investment of $11 million. And that's up from just $2.5 million the year before. Is Mayor Lightfoot doing enough? If not, what more does she need to do?
Well, I think there are lots of structural challenges here. I don't any of us are doing enough. And so we all have to do more. We all have to think differently. We all have to challenge conventional thinking. And I can't think of a more important investment, not just for the city to make, but for the corporate and the philanthropic community to make. So we all have to come to the table. So yes, relative to other cities, I don't think we're investing enough or close to enough in violence prevention. Again, we can't do this all after the fact. If you look, we are 6 to 7 times more violent than New York. we are 2 to 3 times more violent than LA, and yet we have way more police officers. We have twice as many police officers per capita than LA. Something I'm obsessed with is the clear rate. That's the percent of crimes that get solved. Our clear rates for homicides are disastrous. And frankly, that's one of the largest, if not the largest, driver of violence here in Chicago, as I mentioned earlier, is this constant retaliation. You guys talk about getting our lick back because nothing, you know, almost nothing gets solved. And so we all have to invest more, try new things, be willing to fail, but just doing more of the same isn't going to get us where we need to go.
Right, but people don't trust the police to protect them, and they don't trust the police to share the information with them. Do we need to do something like a witness protection program? What do we need to do to build that trust so that people do share information?
Yeah, these are really thoughtful questions, and I'm always going to be very careful. We work with extraordinary individual police officers, and one of the most important peace agreements that was put in place, actually in the community I was talking about earlier in Roseland, where there had been, unfortunately, a tremendous amount of bloodshed on both sides of the conflict, way too many bodies. When one of the leaders of the cliques decided to, he just got tired of it. Enough was enough. It's actually fascinating. What he did is he went and actually knocked on the door of a police officer who lives in the community, Detective Vivian Williams, and basically asked her, would she assist in this? Because there was so much trust there. And because she's not a police officer coming in from another place, she lives on the block. She lives right there. He literally went over to her house and knocked on her door. And so there are amazing individual police who have great relationships. But to your point, Fran, structurally, police with the community is broken. And we haven't been willing to acknowledge that. We haven't been willing to confront that. We haven't been willing to start over and try and rebuild that. Unless we're willing to acknowledge where things aren't working, it's hard to get better.
So how do we do it? How do we repair it?
You have to get out of the cars. You have to walk on blocks. You have to meet people before the moment of crisis. You have to build real relationships. You have to make yourself vulnerable. You have to apologize when things are tough. So these are human relationships. And if it feels like an invading force, if it feels like, I'll just give you a very concrete example where, unfortunately, Thomas's son, Sincere, was killed last Saturday. The next day, Sunday, he and his wife are brought into the police. So the day after, they just lost their 20-month-old who was sitting in the back seat of his mother's car on the way to laundromat to get clean clothes because he was supposed to start daycare last Monday. They are called in the police station and basically re-traumatized by the police the day after their child's been killed. And those kinds of things, there has to be a better way. There has to be a better way.
So he's due an apology then?
I think we just all have to try to see our common humanity. And we've done things, Fran, where we bring together our young men with the police. And it's fascinating. And the conversations can be very, very raw and very intense. But at the end of the day, it's like group therapy. And it's so interesting that everyone's looking for the same thing. Our guys on the street and the police, they are looking not to be stereotyped. They're looking to be treated as individuals. They want to be respected for who they are. And that's the kind of relationship building that we have to be willing to do. This has to be, house by house, block by block. But the only time, you get out of the car is when there's the crisis and where there are no relationships, when everyone is assumed to be a gang member. We had a young man who was one of our leaders in this peace movement, a high school student who was actually volunteering and teaching peace in the community, and actually was just so brilliant, gave me the idea to start our Peacemaker program, which is working with young kids young kids across the city to learn conflict resolution skills. Tragically, he was shot on his porch sitting with his grandfather. And when he was taken to the hospital, he was handcuffed to the bed because he was just assumed, because he's a young black man from the West Side, that somehow he was a gangbanger. It just, you know, that's the kind of thing. It's just unconscionable, but that's real. That's reality. And we have to be willing to confront those hard truths.
The death of George Floyd has given fuel to a nationwide movement to defund the police, to yank them out of public schools, to spend the money on social workers and restorative justice and other social services. The mayor has so far resisted that. How do you feel as a CPS former CEO? Should police officers be in public schools?
Well, I think it's a broader question, sort of how do we reimagine or reinvent what police do. And I'll just give you one school example, but then one broader example. So when I was leading CPS, we had a school on the West Side, North Lawndale College Prep, obviously North Lawndale, one of our most violent communities, where we gave them every year 9 security officers. And that's what we just did. And I'll never forget, the principal called me and said, "Arnie, what if instead of giving me 9 security officers, you gave me 9 social workers?" And I had never thought of something like that. And he took a real risk in doing that. I took a real risk in saying yes, but they saw a tremendous drop in violence. And they used one of those social workers to be a bridge for students once after they graduated to help them in that transition to college. And so, you know, that may not be the right solution everywhere, but in that case, there was a tremendous drop in violence, and it was all about building a healthy community, healthy relationships, trust, having those social workers be there to help kids with their trauma. And so I think we have to be willing to think differently. And so that's you know, one example of one school's choice and what happened. More broadly with the police, I think, you know, every police will say they're called to way too many calls, where it's not about, you know, violence and you know, should they be calling those situations for the George Floyd thing? That's a counterfeit $20 bill. Did you need all those police, you know, coming in that situation? And so I think if we thought about more street outreach workers, more clinicians who can help men heal from their trauma, more social workers, and yes, potentially less police, I think that's the direction we have to go.
And do you think schools should be given the option to cancel the police officers, but given the money to spend elsewhere?
Well, I think, you know, Janice Jackson, I'm a huge fan of hers, and she's really thinking this thing through very carefully. But I think this is about the part of the reason that I said yes in that situation is I had so much confidence in the judgment of that principal who knew his community far better than I ever could. And so I do think really helping, you know, principals and school leaders think through their community needs, what would best help, because you can't compromise on having a safe climate, a safe environment in school, but there are many different ways to do that. And I think really empowering those principals to think through what's the best way to have a calm and peaceful and respectful and safe community so that my students can concentrate on algebra and biology and advanced trigonometry and calculus. There are many ways to try and do that. And I think it's so important that we listen to those, you know, listen to those principles and think that through together.
Can Chicago public schools safely reopen this fall to in-classroom learning? And if so, what will it take?
Well, what's been just so devastating, it has been the lack of leadership by Trump and by the federal government, and the you know, countless deaths. It's the saddest thing to me. I've lost a friend to COVID. So many folks have. I have another friend who's had a couple fingers amputated. He's still battling very significant health issues. It's just has been so preventable. It just is beyond heartbreaking. It's infuriating. And so we as a country haven't taken the hard steps we need to open schools and to make things safe. So, you know, this is the start of July, Fran. And I think what we as a country are willing to do, what small sacrifices we're willing to make so that our children can safely return to school this fall, that's up to us. That's, school systems can't do this by themselves. They don't, they're not, you know, they don't live in a bubble. And we have to be willing to make, you know, again, tiny sacrifices, wear a mask, you know, don't hang out at the beaches, don't go to bars, don't, you know, don't go eat indoors at restaurants. And so we have to sacrifice. If we, you know, everyone says we care about kids, but we just simply have not done what we need to do. The malevolent leadership from DC has been catastrophic, but we have great local leadership working hard on this. The mayor, the governor, Janet Jackson, I think, is doing an extraordinary job here, but we have to give them a chance. And all of us as citizens, we have to understand our common humanity. And if we're not willing to do the right things, then our children are going to struggle. I desperately wanted to have a massive summer school, have kids come back summer to make up for the time they lost during COVID. But that opportunity has come and gone because we as a nation haven't done what other nations have done. And it's just the saddest thing to me.
So what about CPS? Will it be able to, and how, and what about college campuses?
It's too early to tell. And I, you know, everybody wants to go back. There's a real need to go back, but that can only be done if it's safe, if they can do it safely. So what we do in July will determine what happens in August and September. And so this month we have to walk the walk, and we have to do the things that will give our children a chance. So whether it's, you know, K-12 or higher ed, everybody is trying to figure this out every single day. And unfortunately, across the nation, things are surging. And so we have to stop that. We have to test. We have to contact trace. We have to isolate. We have to do the things that we know slow the spread of this pandemic.
And the colleges are desperate to hold on to these students. They know the parents are not going to pay for this enormous tuition if they're not getting in-person learning. And yet, is that going to be safe?
Again, everyone's working through that. And there's no one, you know, people have plan A, plan B, plan C. And our willingness as a country to do the right thing for our nation's young people, that will determine whether it's K-12 or higher ed, how much they're able to do in person.
Arne Duncan, thank you so much, and best of luck to you and your hero's work in the community. We hope you succeed.
Thanks. Long way to go. Take care now.
All right. We'll see you all next week.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.